I want to just make clear one thing. You often hear about human smuggling, which this is, and sometimes it's used interchangeably with human trafficking. That's a very real problem, but it's not what was happening in this case. This is human smuggling, where people went into it with their eyes open. They knew that it would be a hazardous trip to the United States. They knew that it was illegal, but they knew what they were getting into.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, the moderator of the forum. Our guest today is Patrick Keefe. Patrick Keefe is a foreign policy fellow at the Century Foundation in New York. He writes about foreign affairs, national security, and homeland security for many publications, including the New York Review of Books, Slate, and The New Yorker. Many of us in Charlottesville, of course, recall his very interesting piece in The New Yorker last summer about the possibly fraudulent sales of what purported to be Jeffersonian wine. Patrick Keefe holds a bachelor's degree from Columbia University, summa cum laude, a master's in international relations from Cambridge, another master's in new media, information, and society from the London School of Economics, and a law degree from Yale, where he was the book reviews editor for the Yale Journal of International Law. Random House, in 2005, published his first book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. And Patrick Keefe is going to tell us about his next book, which will be published this summer. Please welcome Patrick Keefe.
Thank you very much, George. And thank you for having me. Thank you all for being here. It's a great pleasure to be back in Charlottesville so soon, having been here this past summer researching the Jefferson story, which was a lot of fun. It was about Jefferson's wine, and so I spent a lot of time poking around in the wine cellar at Monticello and going through the voluminous record of Jefferson's various purchases of wine. And most of all, trying to drink as much wine as I possibly could myself. I thought of this as an appropriately Jeffersonian approach to the project at hand. What I want to talk to you about today is completely different, though an issue which Jefferson also had occasion to think about in his time, and that's immigration. And you'll have to bear with me, because in this case, what I want to talk to you about is what started as an article I wrote for The New Yorker 2 years ago and what is now a book that I'm in the process of finishing. So I'm still working out these issues, and I'll be interested in hearing all of your thoughts and reactions shortly. The question that I guess I want to, I mean, really what I want to do is tell you a story. But the question that I want us to be thinking about as I do is about citizenship. What makes an American? At what point do you become an American? Is it a strictly legal thing? Do you have to be a citizen to hold papers? Is it enough to be born here, to marry someone who was born here, to pay taxes, to own property, to fight for the country? At what point in our cosmopolitan, polyglot society does someone actually become American? There's a conflict, I think, in some ways, between two fundamental impulses that we have in this country when we talk about immigration. On the one hand, there's the ideal of the United States as a nation of immigrants, as a refuge for those fleeing tyranny, or a place where those seeking opportunity can come and work hard, and one generation's toil can secure comfort for the next. At the same time, while that's a nice liberal ideal in principle, there are real practical constraints in this day and age to how free and open we can be in that regard. It's difficult, the thought that we might just throw wide the gates and let whoever comes, come. The story I think about, and it's apropos because it has to do with China, is a possibly apocryphal account of an exchange between Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping in the late 70s when the two of them met, and Carter was raising issues about human rights in China. And he said to Deng, "You know, one of the things we're concerned about is that there's not a lot of room for movement within China, and Chinese citizens actually aren't allowed to leave the country in most cases. You've really clamped down, and you're not allowing people this, what we would think of as this fundamental human right, which is to be able to move around and determine your existence in that respect." And allegedly, Deng looked at Carter with a little twinkle in his eyes and said, "Well, President Carter, just how many million would you like?" What my book is about is Chinese immigration to the United States, and particularly about a strange moment in our recent history that has actually gone largely unremarked, but a strange and interesting time in the 1980s and 1990s, when a very large number of Chinese were coming illegally to the US. The numbers are very difficult to determine, but we know that between 1988, 89, as the government became more repressive in China, particularly following Tiananmen Square, right through the middle 90s, there were very, very large numbers of people coming by a whole variety of different means into the US. And again, it's hard to pin down the numbers, but I mean, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about here, James Woolsey estimated before Congress in the mid 90s that we were talking about roughly 100,000 people a year coming. By and large, they would come to New York City. And while nobody can agree on the precise numbers, historians have generally agreed that between 1988 and 1993, more Chinese came to the United States than at any other period in United States history, and that's including the gold rush in the mid-19th century. So that's the period of time that I'm writing about, and I'm writing about the American response to this wave of immigration. One of the things that was interesting is that in the wake of Tiananmen, the George H.W. Bush administration had an executive order in 1990 that made it much easier for people coming from China to obtain political asylum in the United States. Now, there were a number of grounds upon which this might work, but essentially if you came and you said, I've fled China, I don't have any papers, I don't necessarily have a legal right to enter this country, but here I am, and I'm fleeing because I was a supporter of democracy, then chances were you were going to get asylum. The same was true if you came and you said you were fleeing China's one-child policy. You can see, though, what this does. If somebody comes to the United States and they say, China has this policy of limiting you to only one child, in theory, any fertile Chinese person was entitled to asylum in the US. And you would actually get, I've met these people, you would get these young men who would come, they'd be 22 years old, single. And they would come and they would say, I am not married, nor do I have a girlfriend, but someday I will get married. And when I do, I plan to have a very large family. And by remaining in China, I'm prevented from doing that, and so you should give me political asylum. And in many cases, they were granted asylum. In fact, in 1992, the rate of acceptance for asylum claims for Chinese coming illegally to the United States was 85%, which is extremely high. What was really strange about this development, though, is that the people weren't coming from all over China. They were coming from one particular part of the country. And it wasn't even Beijing, where the majority of the crackdowns in 1989 had taken place. They were coming overwhelmingly from Fujian province, which is a small province in the south to the north of Hong Kong, right across the straits from Taiwan. And in fact, from a handful of villages around the southern city of Fuzhou. Now, just to give you a sense of what I'm talking about, this is hundreds of thousands of people a year, or hundreds of thousands of people over the course of several years coming into the United States. And they were all coming from an area that's roughly half the size of Delaware. You actually had a process whereby whole villages were essentially displaced. One person would come, they would send for a few more, they would send for a few more. The Fujianese have an expression, one brings 10, 10 bring 100. And slowly, whole villages would actually migrate to New York City. And you could go to these villages. What would happen is the families in New York would send money back to build bigger homes. And you could go to these tiny little villages that would have these 3- and 4-story McMansions that had been built with the wages of waiters in New York. The irony being that nobody actually lived there because everybody was in New York. And so you'd have these shuttered mansions out in the countryside around Fuzhou. And one of the interesting things about the Fujianese is that they're known within China for being very entrepreneurial. They will start a business whenever it's possible to do so. And so in short order, a business sprung up. Individuals who the Chinese called snakeheads would act as immigration brokers. They would essentially secure you passage to the United States where, if you could get here, it was very likely that you would be able to get political asylum. Now, this passage didn't come cheap. And one of the really interesting things about this this phenomenon is that the fee by about 1992, 1993 was $35,000 a head. And you wonder, well, how could these people possibly have afforded it if, in fact, they are these poverty-stricken Chinese leaving the country? What they would do is they would pay a small down payment. They would cobble together $2,000 or $3,000, and you would pay that to the snakehead in China. Then, provided you actually made it in one piece to the United States, you would owe the balance of that fee. You would borrow the balance as quickly as you could, and then you would spend the next few years paying off the various people that you borrowed from, in some cases relatives, in some cases loan sharks. This industry, the snakehead industry, was estimated by US intelligence and by the UN by the mid-90s to be a $3.5 billion industry. There was a lot of money going into bringing people over in this way. And the person that I'm writing about primarily is a woman named Cheng Chui Ping, who in Chinatown was known as Sister Ping. And Sister Ping was sort of the most famous of the snakeheads. She'd come over herself in the early 80s and had a real knack for business. And she had contacts all over the world, and she would use these contacts to bring people over here and assemble these fees. Now, before she eventually fled the United States, during a 10-year period, Sister Ping is estimated by the FBI to have made about $40 million doing this. And as one of my editors joked, this is $40 million cash. So of course he said, that's $80 million to you and me. I want to just make clear one quick thing. You often hear about human smuggling, which this is, and sometimes it's used interchangeably with human trafficking. And these are in fact discrete things, they're different. With human trafficking, generally what that would imply is there's some kind of false pretenses. The person either doesn't want to be trafficked or moved, or in some cases they've been lied to. It's a young woman who's told that she'll get a job as a model or as a waitress, and she shows up and her passport is taken away from her and she's forced into prostitution. That's a very real problem. But it's not what was happening in this case. This is human smuggling, where people went into it with their eyes open. They knew that it would be a hazardous trip to the United States. They knew that it was illegal. They knew that when they arrived, they were going to have to pay the balance of this enormous fee, and that that might mean working like crazy for several years in order to do so. But they knew what they were getting into. And it was a very attractive business. As one guy in Chinatown told me, who knows some of these snakeheads, he said, oh, well, what happened is everybody who had been dealing drugs before got into the snakehead business because it's a much better business. The profit margins are similar. You can make just as much money moving people as you can moving drugs. But the sentences, if you got caught, were much, much smaller. If you got busted and pled guilty, you could be out of jail in 6 months. So the risk was much lower. And this guy then added, besides, the other thing is your merchandise, your product, can walk. The story that I'm telling in the book and that I did in the article is the story of actually one ship. I wanted to follow the voyage of one rather famous ship. And it's a ship with which Sister Ping was involved. She was not as directly involved with this one as she had been with some others, but she helped finance the voyage. This was a ship called the Golden Venture. It was a fairly small coastal trawler that traveled around the world in 1993 with 300 people in its hold. These 300 people were actually picked up off of, the first lot was picked up off of Thailand, not in China. And so for many of these people, the odyssey actually began by getting to Thailand. And I spoke to people who really, I mean, they had to get to the border with Burma, and then they were snuck into Burma. They trekked through the mountains of Burma for a month, which is a very dangerous trek, and there would be a small team of them walking through the jungle and the mountains. And I mean, in some cases, they would actually see by the side of the path the dead bodies of other Chinese who had gone before them and hadn't been able to survive the trip. They would cover these bodies with banana leaves. They then crossed into Thailand through the Golden Triangle, which in those days was a rather hazardous place to be. They crossed into Thailand and they would wait. And eventually they were picked up by this ship, the Golden Venture. And what followed was a really epic voyage. If you think about it, if you're in China and you want to come to the United States, the thing that would make the most sense is to cross the Pacific to California. But they didn't do this. They sort of went around the long way, down around Africa, up through the Atlantic, past Brazil to New York. There were 300 people in the hold. There was one bathroom. There were no bathing facilities. They were each given a small bowl of rice once a day and a small allotment of water. I've talked to people who were on this voyage, and I've wondered about their commitment to come to the United States, and I've tried to wrestle with it, and it's difficult. And one thing I thought was, well, perhaps I'll find a historical analog. We'll think about other great voyages to America. And so I offer you this. In 1492, it took Columbus 71 days to reach North America. In 1620, it took the Pilgrims aboard the Mayflower 66 days. In 1993, it took the Golden Venture 120 days to reach the coast off of Queens, New York, where it ran aground. The ship ran aground. The snakeheads on board told everybody to jump off, that if they could get to the beach, they would survive. But the water was very cold, and many of the people couldn't swim. At gunpoint, in some cases, they were forced to jump off the side of the ship, and 10 of them died that morning. The authorities rounded up the other 290, and it was a huge media spectacle. Some of you must remember it. I mean, it was early in the Clinton administration. This is June 1993. Every major network, CNN, there were news helicopters covering this. It was enormously embarrassing for the US government and also for the Chinese, I'd add. The interesting thing is that when they arrived, the Clinton administration was faced with a real dilemma. Because in some respects, if you look at the disposition of American policy toward Chinese immigrants leading up until then, it had been essentially encouraging people, in some respects, to come with this promise of asylum once they arrived. But to give asylum to the people once they got here would only be to encourage more ships. And in fact, according to US intelligence reports at the time, when the Golden Venture arrived in New York, there were some 25 other vessels crossing the ocean toward the United States filled with Chinese. There was this sudden recognition that America's policy on immigration was being watched fairly closely on the other side of the world. And so a decision was made to imprison the passengers aboard the Golden Venture. They were basically given a choice. They were told, you can go back to China today and see what happens with you. We can deport you. Or you can wait out your asylum claims here, which might take quite a while, but you're going to have to wait out that time in prison. So they were, by and large, sent to different prisons around the country, most of them to a prison in York, Pennsylvania. You had kind of an interesting thing that went on then as well. The community in York really embraced these Chinese prisoners, and you had a real flip-flop. It's one of the fun things about immigration, of the partisan divide that you would perhaps assume you might get today. What happened in York was that a lot of Republicans who were very anti-communist and very pro-life and therefore really objected strongly to China's one-child policy felt that these people were heroes, that they had suffered through this long voyage and they should be given asylum. And the Clinton administration and Janet Reno were actually coming across as the xenophobes who wanted to lock these people up and punish them for having come to this country illegally. Once they'd thrown these people in jail, the government started going after the snakeheads who brought them here. And Sister Ping was, in some ways, the number one target. She was the number one Asian organized crime figure at the FBI that they were after. She was the most wanted. But she fled. She disappeared and was gone in China before the United States could actually get her. The interesting thing is she didn't stop operating. She actually went back to her home village, where she's regarded as a saint, and continued sending people over. In 1998, there was a ship that she had that made it to Guatemala, which is a kind of a prominent staging point for a lot of these snakehead routes. You get to Central America first, and then overland to the US. And that ship capsized, and 18 people died. But she continued to operate until 2000. When she made the mistake of going to Hong Kong. Now, the United States does not have an extradition treaty with China, but it does with Hong Kong. And in 2000, Sister Ping was in the airport at Hong Kong when she was captured by the Hong Kong authorities. They found her with several passports and $30,000 cash on her, a little black book with contacts in 30 countries, including, in many cases, contacts in the immigration offices in the various countries, because there was an enormous amount of corruption that allowed this to go on. And the really interesting thing is she had a legitimate Belizean passport that she'd been using to travel in the name of a woman named Lily Zhang. And in fact, even during this time when she was so wanted in the United States, she'd been transiting in and out of the country with this other passport. as a guy who used to check out passports of new arrivals at Toronto Airport once joked to me, he said, think of this as the blowback for the idea that they all look alike. Sister Ping was eventually extradited to New York and tried in 2006. She was convicted and sentenced by Michael Mukasey, interestingly enough, while he was still a federal judge, to 35 years. So his reputation as a law and order kind of guy is probably well earned. For the Department of Justice, it was a great victory that they had put her away basically for the rest of her life. She's now in her 50s. But interestingly, in Chinatown, where I've been spending a lot of time, she's regarded as a hero and a martyr. There are a lot of people in Chinatown who don't regard what she did as, strictly speaking, a crime, even though they understand that it is, technically, in terms of American law. They think that, you know, in terms of the people who died on the Golden Venture, on the boat in Guatemala, they feel as though they were acceptable risks. People knew what they were getting into when they got aboard. And they say she's Robin Hood. I object that Robin Hood never made $40 million, but they're adamant. So what became of the people on the Golden Venture? Well, the interesting thing is they were essentially forgotten about. They were there, most of them, in jail for the next 4 years. And in 1997, the New York Times ran a front page story saying, hey, you remember the Golden Venture? Those guys are all still in jail. The next day, President Clinton was about to deliver the State of the Union address, and as he was walking down, the representative, Bill Goodling, from the district in York, where the jail in Pennsylvania was, took him aside and said, Mr. President, I still have all these Golden Venture passengers in my jail. And Clinton said, that's right, I just read about that in the New York Times. Clinton then let them out, but he didn't actually give them citizenship. What he did was he paroled them out, which puts them into a kind of a curious, somewhat nebulous status. They're allowed to be here. They're allowed to own property, own businesses, pay taxes. They have American children. Their children go to school. Some of them will soon be going to college. But at any moment, they could actually be deported. It's essentially at the whim of the government. So they're allowed to be here, and yet they're not. They don't have the confidence that you would have if you were a naturalized citizen or even a green card holder. And part of what's interesting is these guys are now, I think, real stakeholders in American society who, some might argue, have paid their dues. They have these very Americanized kids. They're here and have really put down permanent roots, and yet they feel as though they're in this limbo, and they're still in it now, 11 years after being paroled. This is strange for me, and this is what I'll end with, and I hope we can talk about it more, because one of the interesting things about these guys as they were, and by the way, it was almost all men. It was overwhelmingly men who were aboard the Golden Venture, a small number of women. But one of the strange things about it is that they, when they were in the prison in York, they were looking for a way to bide the time. And a lot of them tried to learn English, and they got Chinese-English dictionaries, and they would read the newspapers when the guards were done with the newspapers. But a couple of these guys had been real craftsmen back in Fuzhou and got into paper folding. And so they would say, hey, don't throw that magazine away, or don't throw that newspaper away, and they would start folding these intricate little sculptures. There were a couple of them who were really good at this, and the others said, oh, let me see, how do you do that? Show me how this is done. And they started making the sculptures. And the sculptures got more and more diverse and interesting and bigger and more ambitious, and they figured out that they could take toothpaste and mix it up with newspaper under the faucet, and they could come up with a kind of paper mache. And then they were allowed to have markers, and they would color these things in, and they would make huge pagodas and fruits and all these interesting designs. One of the great ironies here is that this material, I mean, this art, which they started selling and started getting a fair amount of press coverage, eventually actually showed it. They had an exhibit at the Smithsonian while the guys who made it were still in jail. But one of the really remarkable things is that if you look at the art that they made in prison, a lot of it was American flags and bald eagles. I mean, overwhelmingly bald eagles. These symbols, what I think of in some respects as these kind of hokey symbols of Americana. And it's remarkable to me that their devotion to the idea of America remained untrammeled after what they'd been through, after being put in prison. And I talk to these guys today, even now, when they still have this nebulous status after all these years. And most of them work in restaurants today. Most of them are sort of, you know, working class guys, but trying to make the American dream happen and really hoping that their kids can go to American colleges. And I ask them if they regret it, if they regret the voyage, if they regret coming here, if they regret the time in prison, if you look at China's economy today, if they regret having ever left. And 201, they say they don't, that the sacrifice was worth it. And of late, for me personally, there have been moments where I feel at best a little bit ambivalent about being American. And I look at these guys and what they went through and where they are today, and I can't help but conclude in some way that they're more American than I'll ever be. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. I would like to move to the back of the room and invite those of you who have questions to meet me in the back. And we have about 30 minutes that we can invest in a dialogue with Patrick Keefe. Patrick, to sort of start off the discussion, you mentioned that the rise in immigration from China, this latest wave, as well as the formation of the United States response, really came following Tiananmen Square, a radical uprising, really, by young people in China. If we look at what's going on in other parts of the world, if we look at our efforts to eradicate the poppy business in Afghanistan, which certainly will probably accelerate, and to make that into some, get those people into some sort of legitimate business, if we look at how few immigrants have been permitted to enter from Iraq, and yet will be enormous pressure in the next few years, what are the implications of these upheavals in these other countries for our immigration policy? Will we follow the model we followed with China? Will the local people do what the Chinese did and fight very hard to become Americans? What's your sense as to what will happen?
Well, that's a big question. I guess I have two answers. One is that I think particularly in the case of an instance like Iraq, and I'm thinking, I mean, this is in a way the low-hanging fruit, but I'm thinking about the many Iraqis who helped us when we first went in there and worked as translators and what have you, and risked their lives in that respect, and who we have not given asylum or citizenship to here. I think there you get the collision I was talking about earlier between the ideals that we represent and the way we would like to think of our country on the one hand, and then various pragmatic considerations on the other. But I don't think that actually we're going to see a lot of blowback in the form of Iraqis making their own way here. And I don't think that we'll see it with Afghans either. One reason is that what you do see is people flooding into other surrounding countries, flooding into neighboring countries, and I think that that will be a political problem for the United States as our allies come to us and say, look, we're being flooded with people. I mean, I know for the Saudis, it's a major concern. They're building a wall in order to prevent people from flooding over their borders. But in some respects, the story of the Chinese, I think, was kind of anomalous. And the reason for that is that in all my discussions with immigration officials, what they say is that there's illegal immigration, even organized illegal immigration, and then there's Chinese illegal immigration. The level of sophistication that these networks developed coming from China to the United States was like nothing anyone had ever seen before, and I think by and large, like nothing they've seen since. So I don't know that we would necessarily see that kind of organized, networked global operation happen again, unless that is, and this is an issue that people are worrying about now, because these Chinese networks are still in business, people of other ethnicities start paying the Chinese to bring them in, start paying the fees. And I've certainly, it's my understanding that on the northern border, where a lot of the Chinese bring people in from Canada, immigration authorities are now seeing what they call mixed loads. So groups of people coming in under the supervision of Chinese snakeheads who aren't necessarily Chinese.
The fertility replacement rate is 2.1 children per female. in order to maintain the stable population in a country. Right now, virtually all of Europe has a fertility replacement rate well below that. And in fact, in the United States right now, our fertility replacement rate is 1.9. In order to maintain a stable population, and we do maintain it because of immigration, but my question is the level of legal immigration that we allow in this country adequate to maintain our population, in your estimation?
I don't know the figures. I would have to look into the, I'm sure demographers have done work on that. My guess would be just by virtue of the fact that, the silly thing, right, about the immigration debates we have today is that there is a population of 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States. And if you were to suddenly whisk them out tomorrow, that would be a huge demographic and economic hit on the country. So, I mean, in that respect, I think we rely to some extent on the illegal population. But as far as new illegals coming in every year, I don't know the answer to that. I'd be interested to see the research.
What effect do you think the North American Free Trade Agreement has had on immigration, particularly illegal immigration from Latin America?
I think it certainly had an effect. The southern border is not, so again, it's a little bit beyond my particular expertise because the southern border is not something I've looked into as closely. I have to say, I'm sure it's accelerated the process to some extent, but as far as actually facilitating people coming over, my sense is that you don't need much facilitation. I mean, there are huge stretches of the border in the south and the north where you can essentially walk across. It's hazardous, it's risky for the person doing it. But that's a risk that in most cases they seem willing to undertake.
China itself has an immigration problem. From North Korea, several of its provinces are primarily North Korean now. Is there any evidence that those North Koreans enter this pipeline and make it to the United States?
That's a great question. I mean, I haven't heard of any evidence of that, but it is certainly true that China has this problem. When I was in Hong Kong last spring, I was talking to immigration officials, and to some extent, I'm so out of date because what I'm writing is basically a history book dealing with the 1980s and 1990s, and I would go to these immigration officials and say I wanted to talk about human smuggling and China, and they all assumed automatically I meant human smuggling into China, not human smuggling out of it, because everybody around the region is desperate to get in. I haven't heard anecdotally about cases in which North Koreans would have actually made their way to the snakehead networks and gotten through, though it wouldn't surprise me in the least to know that it had happened. The other interesting thing, getting to the demographic issue with China, is that China now has this huge imbalance because of the one-child policy. One of the results of that is that China has far, far, far more men than women. I don't know the numbers, but I mean, it's wildly disproportionate because for a variety of reasons, people in rural communities would prefer to have sons than daughters. And I know that one way in which they're correcting that is smuggling North Korean brides in, because it's very difficult for a lot of Chinese men in some of these areas to find wives. There just aren't enough women to go around. So the dynamics of the smuggling are fairly interesting, and the way in which they map onto the demographic needs of the society are pretty, pretty rich and interesting.
Thank you for a very nice talk. I was wondering what your feelings are on human trafficking. I spent some time in San Francisco, and often there would be stories about massage parlors and houses of prostitution filled with people smuggled in from China in particular. But overall, do you think that's a big problem here?
I do. I mean, I think it's a very big problem. Tell me if this makes any sense. I think it's a very big problem, which is nevertheless overstated. I think that it is it's a real problem, and it's happening all over the place. I mean, it's happening within Europe, from Eastern Europe to Western Europe. It's happening from Asia to the United States. It's happening from Mexico to the United States. A lot of it is tied up, I would say perhaps most of it is tied up with the sex trade, though in some cases it's making children, forcing children into cheap labor and what have you. Having said that, there have been some instances in which people have gone after the hard numbers, which are notoriously elusive in this kind of underworld economy. And there does seem to be some suggestion that the rate at which this is happening can be overstated. It's also difficult intellectually because, I mean, when I said earlier that you have these two different things, human smuggling and human trafficking, and that the difference is essentially that you know what you're getting into, I mean, it's a useful distinction to make, and one I wanted to make because people often use those terms interchangeably, but they're also on a continuum to some extent. I mean, somebody comes from China and they know that they're going to have to do backbreaking labor that, you know, is almost would amount to slavery, except for the fact that they kind of went in seeing what they're going to do. I think the tricky thing for a lot of the advocacy groups that are concerned about human trafficking is, what do you do with a young woman who thinks, I want to get out of where I am now, and I want to get into this other place, and if I have to go into prostitution in order to do that, then so be it. I mean, that is tricky, because it doesn't really fit into either of these two models. And so those are the cases in which I think that, Nick Kristof in the New York Times goes to Cambodia, where children are being forced into sex slavery, and he pays to buy a little girl out of a brothel and return her to her home village. He does so, he writes about it, and a year later, she goes back to the brothel. I think we're deep into a fairly depraved context here, but I think those raise really difficult questions.
I gather from what you said that a large number of these Chinese came from that province and settled in New York City or around New York, and then maybe some of those prisoners are around York, Pennsylvania. I'm curious to know about the children. You said some of them are even approaching college. How were these children assimilated into the schools? Did we have a two-language program in the schools of New York City? I've never heard anything about that. I'd like to know how the children were educated here and how they're doing, apparently well.
The children are doing great, and when you look at something like assimilation, it sort of runs the gamut in terms of the families from the Golden Venture. But there are two interesting things to observe. The first is that, remember I told you the Fujianese are very entrepreneurial? Historically, what would happen if you were Chinese and you came legally or illegally to the United States, you would start, unless you had family elsewhere, you would start in one of the major Chinatowns. But what happened with the Fujianese is that they got, in many cases, to New York in the 80s and 90s and realized, well, what's the point of me opening a Chinese restaurant right here with all these other Chinese restaurants? I want to go way out to some place where there are no Chinese people and open them there. So today, the guys from the Golden Venture are scattered all across the country. I mean, I've visited them they're in Washington, they're in Oklahoma, they're in Ohio, they're in Florida. They're all over, and often they own the little strip mall Chinese restaurant that is the only Chinese place in town. What that has meant, I think, is a higher degree of assimilation for the children, for the second generation, because they're not in a place that actually has a concentrated population of other Chinese speakers. And the other thing that's interesting is, in a way, in some cases the parents haven't assimilated all that much, but in order for the parents to survive in American society and run a business and pay taxes and pay their mortgage, they need the kids to assimilate. So these families, and I've seen it again and again, you can call, and in some cases the parents to this day don't speak English all that well. But they put the kid on the phone, and you realize that the kid is the public face of the family. And so the kid in some ways is kind of forced by necessity into some level of assimilation. And I think ultimately that sets the kids in good stead. I mean, that ultimately prepares them for American high school, for college, for a life that is, you know, not the kind of ghettoized existence you might have in a Chinatown.
Whence cometh the spouses for the prisoners in Erie? And how does this tangle up their legal status years down the road?
Great question. This is the most extraordinary thing. In many instances, these men came on the Golden Venture and their wives still live in China. In some cases, the wives came illegally on their own and they had children. In some cases, the wives were able to actually get green cards and then were able to sort of retroactively get them for the husbands. In some cases, marriages fell apart and the men remarried. And in many cases, also, the men on the Golden Venture came unmarried. I mean, they were the sort of the type who would have been on that ship was a young man in his 20s out kind of seeking his fortune. But the way in which it works with the families is really extraordinary, because what happens is then that either the wife will come over here or they'll marry here, or in some cases the wife will stay and they'll just send money home, and some of these guys are still sending money home. And then if they can, they'll have children here. Those children are born U.S. citizens. And the first thing that they do is send the children back to China. Because the children are U.S. citizens now, they go back, they're raised by the grandparents for their first 4 or 5 years until they're old enough for school in the U.S., because many of these guys are working so hard. Many of them work 13 out of 14 days a week. They get a day off twice a month. And they're working 11, 12, 13-hour days. So it's kind of interesting. They have kids here, send them back to China, sort of reversing the migration of the parents. And then as soon as the kids are old enough for school, they'll come back here and attend elementary school here.
I have a two-part question, actually. I'm wondering why a large percentage of this people who left were from Fujian province and not Guangdong or Xinjiang or even Tibet. And secondly, the Fujian economy has really taken off in the past 15 years because all the industries from Taiwan have moved over. And so a lot of people are getting rich in Fujian. And how has that impacted the number of people leaving at this point?
Yes. Well, this is one of the mysteries is why so many people came from that particular province. And there are a lot of different explanations. One is that Fujian had always been more outward looking than a lot of other provinces. It's right on the coast. There had always been a kind of a seafaring tradition in Fujian. And in fact, if you look at the various Pacific Rim countries that have large Chinese populations, in country after country after country, those populations, if you were to actually look at the ethnicity, they're disproportionately Fujianese. They're Fujianese who left in the 18th century and the 19th century and sort of set out to start businesses in those places. The really interesting thing, though, is that, of course, Fujian was not the poorest, most beleaguered province in China. And the answer there has been some good demographic research on, and it's essentially that outmigration is not caused by absolute poverty. Generally, when you have outmigration in a particular country, it's not the very poorest, or for that matter, the very richest, because the very poorest can't afford to go. They're there in their environment. They don't even have the means to kind of figure out that it would be a possibility. The very richest are doing all right. It's people in the middle. And what really drives it is not absolute poverty, but what they call relative deprivation. So in a really weird way, just as the economy was beginning to take off in Fujian after the reforms, it was a number of special economic zones were set up in the 1980s in precisely this area. And as the economy started doing better, you suddenly got disparities of wealth that hadn't existed there before. And so people would be there looking at their neighbor, and whereas 10 years before their neighbor was in exactly the same lot they were, suddenly their neighbor was doing a little bit better. And that made people start to wonder. And then you have people go to the States where they could actually make some real money and send it home. And I mean, really make in a month what they might make in a year back in China and send that money home. And the Fujianese could be a bit ostentatious with that wealth. I mean, the money would come home and they'd erect a huge house and there'd be a big banner that said, you know, this is from our relatives overseas. And a sense developed. I mean, people have literally called it a fever. You'd have farmers who would drop their tools and just do anything to get on one of these ships. A sense developed that if you weren't making an effort to come to the U.S., then you were just lazy and unimaginative. I mean, of course, only time tells, right? And now we look back and probably it would have made more sense for them to just buy a piece of real estate in central Fuzhou and hold on to it. But, 2020 hindsight.
I have a question and a statement. I'll start with the statement. I recently come from southern Florida, and there the issue of human trafficking is so severe that the sheriff departments in Collier counties and adjacent counties are sending flyers in the mail calling attention to it. And it seems to me that there may be a point at which the human trafficking and the smuggling come together, and that is when the victim of the human smuggling and the person who has been smuggled, human trafficking and the person who has been smuggled are discovered. The problem is what to do with them. The next question I have is huge numbers of Hong Kong citizens, the well-to-do especially, came to Western Canada after the British lost control of Hong Kong. Did you do any research in that area?
To your statement, yes, I think that to some extent the policy dilemma is the same. What do you do when they get here? One of the tricky things is that for those who are really vehemently opposed to human trafficking, many are arguing that we should afford asylum to those who are trafficked here. But then one kind of hard-nosed pragmatic objection to that is that if you do that, then essentially you're rewarding the people who end up getting trafficked. And that might actually, you might have a situation where just as the Chinese coming over in 92, 93 could come over and say one-child policy and they would get asylum, you might have people who could be smuggled over now and say, I was trafficked, and they would get asylum. I mean, ultimately, these asylum decisions require a kind of a Solomonic level of discretion, which makes any kind of one-size-fits-all policy extremely difficult. The second question about Hong Kong, I know that people were coming. I didn't realize that they would. I mean, it makes sense that they would be coming to Western Canada because there have traditionally been very, very close links. And in fact, a lot of the smuggling that would go on, a lot of the routes, even for the Fujianese, would be Fuzhou, Hong Kong, Toronto or Vancouver, and then they would make their way to New York or LA. The context in which I've looked into this, which is very much echoing what you're suggesting, is capital flight, is that the wealthy in Hong Kong were buying up property in Chinatowns around America and American property during these years. I mean, not so much in and after 97, but sort of leading up to it through the early 90s. Again, we can now regard that as perhaps an investment mistake, but at the time it probably seemed East Broadway probably seemed a better bet than Hong Kong.
The first thing that came to my mind when you mentioned the smugglers' fees was $35,000 is about 1 year in a college or university in this country for private tuition. You mentioned your ambivalence about the immigrants who settled here, but how do you feel about the smugglers and the role they played? Did you come to some judgment about that?
I have much less sympathy with them. While I have a great deal of sympathy, some of it more emotional or instinctive than analytical for the guys who are on the Golden Venture, just having seen what they've gone through and looking at the resilience of their spirit and their devotion to this country, I think Sister Ping and her ilk were, in a way, I mean, they were the worst of all. They were shamelessly exploiting the possibilities that America holds out. They were shamelessly exploiting the kind of depravity that people were escaping in China, and they were shamelessly exploiting the natural human tendency to hope and think that, if I endure this now, if I endure any hardship at this juncture, things will be better for me and my children once I arrive. I understand that illegal immigration is a tricky business. But I've been researching Sister Peng for 2 years now, and her husband she arrived in 82. By 84, she was smuggling. In 89, her family put 4 people on a rubber raft, a $69 rubber raft, on the Niagara River in January, and one of them was a 7-year-old girl, and that raft overturned, and they died. And I could imagine a moral universe in which I was her, and that happened, and I realized, boy, I'm in way over my head here. I can't do this anymore. This is a brutal business. But she didn't. She kept going, and the bodies kept piling up. So I think it's interesting, and I think that there are real cultural, interesting kind of cultural questions that come up when I talk to the Fujianese who say, I mean, and you should see, I mean, back in the villages in China, she's revered as a living Buddha. There were, when her sentence came up, and it came out to 35 years, various people from the villages signed a petition saying that they would each serve a year of the sentence. Some people cynically joked that this was, you know, if you bring us to the United States, we'll serve a year of the sentence each. But I mean, they really have a real sincere regard for her, and I think that there's something fascinating when you think about our two countries and the way in which this the kind of friction and interface that happens with immigration in teasing those differences out. But ultimately, while I think 35 years was pretty severe, I do tend to come down with the prosecutors in thinking that you know, you can have some sympathy for the people who are moved, but the movers themselves and the kind of money they make doing it really don't merit much sympathy at all.
Thank you very much for a really great talk. My question is really very simple. Why do people, it matters not what where they're coming from, why do they immigrate here, especially the Chinese that you're talking about?
I think it's a, I mean, there are a variety of answers to that. One is obviously that people, when there are two different things, there's somebody leaving a country, there's somebody leaving China because they feel as though they're under the boot of local party cadres and they're never going to be in a position where they can actually, I mean, I talked to a guy who said, in America, we'll come and we'll work like slaves, but things will get better for the next generation. And he said, if I'm a farmer in Fuzhou, and this is back in the 80s, if I'm a farmer in Fuzhou with a little piece of land or a fisherman with a boat, things are never going to get better. They're not going to get better for my kids. They're not going to get better for my grandkids. There's no sense of mobility. So that explains why people leave. But one of the interesting things for people at, say, JFK Airport, who had to decide, you know, the Chinese would come and they would ask for asylum. And these guys would actually be able to figure out, the guys at the airport would be able to figure out that they had actually transited through 4 different countries after leaving China and before getting to the United States. And they would sort of say, oh, why are you picking on us? If all you want is political asylum, if all you wanted was out of China, why didn't you, when you were stopped at the Vancouver airport, why didn't you announce your asylum claim there? And I think that gets to what is special about the United States, and I do think that comes back to this ideal of the United States as a country where, if one generation is willing to pay with their labor, the next generation can really secure a level of comfort and a level of investment and a real kind of realization of the American dream. And I think that sometimes that's true, and I think it's an ideal we announce in the Emma Lazarus poem at the foot of the Statue of Liberty. And it's one that we depart from periodically because of these sudden panics and because of these kind of sudden pragmatic awakenings that, no, Mr. Deng, we cannot take a million Chinese. But nevertheless, I think it's an ideal with a lot of currency. And part of the irony for me is that even today, as we're experiencing a moment, I think, of at least at the level of political sort of public discourse, at least on the Lou Dobbs show, we're experiencing a great deal of xenophobia. Even as we are, there is still this kind of incessant notion of America as this special nation, a land where freedom means something different than it does in other countries, a place where the opportunities, if you're willing to come here and work hard, are really boundless. And I think one of the interesting things, at least in China, is we broadcast that message and they hear it and they heard it. And in some respects, my sympathy for the guys on the Golden Venture is that they got that message, and some of them spent 2 years getting here and then 4 years in jail. And they arrived and it was cruelly withheld. But it's a testament to the power of that message, whether it's true or not, that people are still coming.
In formulating our national immigration policy, and I assume that this is going to be a centerpiece issue in the coming months, how much weight should be accorded to the conditions in the country from which people wish to migrate, and how much weight should be accorded to the economic realities of the United States satisfying our labor needs?
I think that in answer to the first part of your question, I think that to the extent that we can, if there is any merit and substance to this idea that we are a refuge for those fleeing very bad situations, then I think we should give a good deal of weight to the circumstances people are leaving. There are two problems with that, and I don't necessarily have a perfect answer, but I think that there are two reasons why you would temper that. One is on a practical level, it's very, very difficult for an administrative judge, not even an administrative judge, but in the initial hearing for asylum before any of the appeals, for the individual making those, again, incredibly decisive, difficult choices to know whether or not they're being told the truth. One of the really tragic aspects of the Golden Venture story is that as these guys got here and were out having their administrative hearings of their asylum claims, there was a memo from the State Department which said, we think that asylum applicants from Fujian province are being coached by the snakeheads to tell a certain story. Here are three or four familiar stories that you might expect to hear. And the stories are all things like, my wife and I had a second child, the local cadres took my wife away and forced her to have an abortion, and then they sterilized me. Or they threatened to sterilize me, and I escaped, and I'm here now because if I go back, I'll be sterilized. And this memo was distributed to the judges who were going to be hearing these claims, saying, here are some familiar stories to look for. Now, some proportion of the time, you probably had someone on the Golden Venture who was lying and telling that story because they'd heard that it was a way to get asylum. But some proportion of the time, you had somebody who was telling the truth because it was actually something that happened. And the judge would hear this story, and as soon as those basic elements of the story were there, the judge would immediately say, you're not credible, and write, not credible, and that was that. And there's at least one documented instance in which somebody came over and said, they said they were gonna sterilize me. This is a guy on the Golden Venture. The judge said, you're not credible. The guy was sent back, and he was sterilized. These are difficult choices, and so I think that you do need to bear it in mind, obviously, what they're fleeing, but also from a kind of empirical point of view, you need to be as careful and rigorous as you can, while not prejudicing them necessarily, to figure out the truth of their claims. The second thing, just quickly, is that this message sending works in a variety of different ways. I mean, part of the trouble, I think, is that if you say, you are fleeing, when we say if you're fleeing the one-child policy, then we will, it's the same thing that happens with the Cubans. When we say if you can get here, then there's a good shot you can stay here, we are sending a message to people that says whether by hook or by crook, you should get here and you can risk your life doing it. And you can show up without documents. And I think the problem is that if you take a hard look at the kinds of risks people are willing to undergo, to some extent, on some level, even in our efforts to be inclusive, we become an accomplice to the kind of suffering that people undergo when we hold out this idea that if you can just show up, we'll let you in. And as for the economic needs, I think it's important. I mean, I think if you look at the various immigration legislation over the years, it's very often strongly informed by the lobbying efforts of the growers, for instance, in California and places like that. But I think that there's also, I mean, for me, the more fundamental point is that there's this idea that that illegal immigrants are really bad for our economy, that they're this huge drag on our economy. And I'm not an economist, but I've read some of the literature, and it seems to me that when you actually look at the numbers, that's just not the case, and is perhaps a myth we should lay to rest.
I hope that this will be the first of many visits we have at the Miller Center from Patrick Keith. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.